Well, hello, boys and girls, and welcome to Reading with Rick again, as it is Tuesday night. And we've got a couple of fun stories for you here this evening. What a beautiful day it was today. Lots of sunshine. I hope you enjoyed today, because I don't think the sun's going to shine too much tomorrow, but who knows? What do we have tonight? Well, we're going to start. This story is about another type of animal. I don't think we've had this type of animal before. A kangaroo is the star of tonight's first story. And the name of the story, in a book written by David Stein, the name of the book is Pouch. Pouch, the name of the book. And then when we finish with that book, we'll go right into our second book tonight, and we will finish up, or at least try to. I think we got about halfway through last night. Wrestling Sturbridge. If you remember last night, that story is about four young guys, and they're in high school, and they're all on the wrestling team, and they're all pretty good wrestlers, but only three of the four are probably going to make the lineup because two of them are at the same weight class. One of them is the best in the state, and we're going to find out what happens to those wrestlers tonight in Sturbridge. Wrestling Sturbridge, the name of our second story. So let's get started with Pouch tonight. Pouch, the name of our first story on this gorgeous, gorgeous Tuesday night. Okay. It begins with a picture of a mama kangaroo and a baby kangaroo in her pouch. And it starts, when he was a brand new kangaroo, Joey lived in the pouch. Until one day, he peeked out and saw the world, and his mama smiling down at him. Mama, said Joey, I want a hop. And he climbed out of Mama's pouch and took two hops right to the tall grass. Who are you? Said the little Joey. And he's talking to a bumblebee. And the bee says, I'm Bee. Pouch, said Joey. And that must have scared Joey because he went running back to Mama and he hopped right into her safe pouch again. And Mama wrapped her arms around her pouch and gave him a big squeeze. But soon Joey wanted to hop again, and he crawled out of Mama's pouch, and he went exploring again. He took three hops to the little hill, and he found somebody else. He said, who are you? And it was Rabbit. Pouch, said Joey, and he went hopping back to Mama's pouch. He was safe and sound in Mama's pouch, wasn't he? When he gets scared, he hops back to Mama. But soon, Joey wanted to hop again. This time, he took four hops to the sandy hollow. And he came upon somebody else in the hollow, and he said, who are you? And sitting on a log, perched on a branch, he said, bird. And Joey hopped back up right to Mama's pouch and said, pouch. But every time, he's going a little bit further away, so he's got further to hop back. Soon, Joey wanted to hop again. This time, he took five hops to the pasture fence. Now, kangaroos, they can hop pretty far in one hop, so when he took five hops, that put him quite a ways. You can barely see Mama Kangaroo keeping an eye on him in the distance. So he went five hops to the pasture fence, and he found somebody else there. Who are you? And that somebody answered and said, kangaroo. He found another kangaroo. Pouch, said the two kangaroos. And they both started back to their mamas. But wait, said Joey. You were afraid of me too? And they both started to laugh. And then they hop, 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 hoppity hopped everywhere together. And you can see the two mama kangaroos and the bee and the bird and the rabbit all keeping an eye on those two kangaroos. They're now friends and they're hopping around together. And both mamas now come up to the two little baby kangaroos and say, "Pouch?" And the two joeys say, "No thanks." So they're not scared anymore. And that's the end of Pouch by David Stein. So you can always go home to mama and she'll keep you safe. But you'll find out that it's not so bad to be out on your own either. You'll find some friends. And that's what Joey did tonight. So when we come back, we'll have our conclusion of our book called Wrestling Stourbridge. We'll find out what happens to those wrestlers as we have the second half. That'll come up right after this. So those of you heading off to bed, you have a good night's sleep, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Are you all settled in and ready to finish off the second half of our book called Wrestling Stourbridge? Remember last night we talked about a group of guys that are wrestlers and they're just getting ready to start their season and they're really good. And we're going to see what happens. So here we go with tonight's second reading of Wrestling Stourbridge. We pick up in Chapter 6. It's December. You can't help but be electrified by the noise, though I'm trying hard not to be. The varsity guys burst out of the locker room and start circling the mat, and everybody in the stands is on their feet chanting, "Stourbridge, stamp, stamp, Stourbridge." I start rubbing my shoulder. It really doesn't hurt anymore, but I'm feeling conspicuous, embarrassed to be sitting here in regular clothes in a folding chair next to the assistant coach. Al is jumping up and down out there, shoving Hatcher playfully, and then making a fist toward the stands. The pep band is playing On Wisconsin here in Pennsylvania, and there isn't an empty seat in the whole gym. My father's up there, and Kim is up on the very top row with her girlfriends. The guys from West and South are warming up on the side of the gym, looking around and probably feeling intimidated. Nobody's come in here and beat us in 9 years. The bleachers are speckled with shiny blue Stourbridge Wrestling Boosters Association jackets. Anybody who actually wrestled has his graduation year and nickname stitched on the chest. Spins, 83. Bucky, 78. Some of them even carry old clippings from the Stourbridge Observer in their wallets to settle arguments. Everybody's got a hat on, too. I'm the only guy in town who doesn't wear an advertisement for a bar, a tractor, a sports team, or a cigarette on his head. There's one rather large person in the front row with a jacket labeled Mom, which I'm sure she thinks is cute, but it's actually useful information, because otherwise it would be hard to tell if she's a man, a woman, or a Bulgarian shot putter. Hatcher's father is walking out to the mat with a microphone for the announcements. They do this every year at the first match. The Booster Club president introduces the local dignitaries, who are always the same. Peter Valdez and Jerry Franken, the town state champions. Mayor Andrew Watt, who we all say? No, Watt. The principal, the wrestling coaches, the captains, who are Al and Hatcher. I catch Al's father looking at me, and I nod. He gives me a thumbs-up signal. The band starts playing their other song, Louie Louie, and little Anthony Terranova, our man at 103, starts putting on his headgear and talking to the coach. Anthony races onto the mat. He's a sophomore, but just barely beat Tommy Austin in the wrestle-off 2 days ago. Al beat me 9-2 in ours. He takes down the guy from South in about 4 seconds and has him on his back right away. He's got him cradled, and he's driving hard with his legs. The ref slams the mat for a pin, and the place erupts as the first match of the season ends in 28 seconds. Al and Digit leap off the bench and start hugging Anthony, who he goes down the line slapping five with everybody. The Sturbridge chant starts again, and the music, and somebody tosses a roll of toilet paper onto the mat, which is another one of the traditions. It unravels maybe 40 sheets and comes to a stop at the edge of the mat. The referee picks it up and carries it over to our coach, who grins and sends the next wrestler out. By the time Digit gets out there, we're up 15-3, and it gets better. He and his opponent circle around each other for about 30 seconds. Then Digit shoots in and flips a guy, and it's almost over before you realize it. Digit puts a towel around his neck, picks up a squirt bottle, and sits next to me. He yells the whole time while Al and Hatcher pin their guys in the first period, then sits back and watches the rest of the match. We wind up winning 54-9. People pour out of the stands onto the mat, and the guys who wrestled start working their way toward the locker room. I just stand there looking around and looking dumb. Al's father wanders up to me and grabs my arm. "Nice job out there tonight," he says to me, and I don't think he's being sarcastic. "Thanks," I say. I mean, they did really good. "We kicked their butts," he says, looking around, probably for Al. He's skinny with kind of long hair for a guy as old as he is, and it's curly and dark with streaks of gray. He sticks a finger in his ear and starts scratching with it. It's just the two of them. Al's mother died a couple of years ago. Cancer. Al's got an older brother in the army who I haven't seen in a long time. Kim waves at me from over by the exit, and I put up two fingers like a wave. I start walking toward the locker room. Tommy Austin is standing under the basket talking to three girls who wouldn't normally have given him the time of day. But he's wrestling JV and pinned his opponent, and everybody figures he'll be varsity pretty soon. We've already stopped calling him Susan. Tim Royce, 171 2 years ago, sticks out his hand to me, and I shake it. "You hurt?" he asks. "Nah, what's up?" I shrug, kind of a bottleneck. I'm odd man out right now. "Too bad," he starts rubbing his chin. His T-shirt says Penn State Athletic Department, but he goes to Weston Community College. And he's obviously not wrestling there, as he's up to at least 200 pounds. "Get tougher," he says. "Yeah, see you around." I reach the door to the lockers, but I don't have any reason to go in. Kim's talking to one of her friends, but I know she's waiting for me, even though we didn't make any plans or anything. I duck into the door and head down the stairs to the locker room, which is already thick with steam. Music is blaring and guys are whooping it up. Coach spots me and he's all smiles. "Benji," he says. "Benny man, great show tonight, huh?" "Fantastic," I say, but my voice is flat. "Best team this school's ever had," he says, which may be so, but they've got an awful lot to prove first. Coach turns into his office and I head for the exit. Al's by his locker with 1 foot up on the bench and he's drying between his toes with a towel. "Hey," he says. "Hey," I say back. "Your old man was looking for you." "Oh, yeah, he's still upstairs?" "I think so." "Would you tell him I'll be right up? I'll meet him outside." "Sure." Hatcher's standing there half-dressed staring at Al. "You're going home with your father?" he says, as if it's the most unbelievable thing he's ever heard. "Yeah," Al says. "I had to cut weight today, remember? I ain't eaten anything since 6 o'clock this morning. He probably hasn't either." "I thought we were going to hang out," Hatcher says. "Guess not," Al says, drying his armpits as he walks away from Hatcher. Hatcher looks after him with a screwed-up frown, then yells over to Digit to see if he's up for hanging out. I go upstairs and tell Al's father he's coming, and finally get out of there. In the parking lot, I bump into Jerry Franken, which really sucks because I'm trying to get away from this. He puts a beefy arm around me, and I can tell he had garlic for dinner. "That Al is something," he says to me. "Sure is." "Must be tough to watch," I start nodding my head. "It is. Can't you move up?" "I've been through this 1,000 times, with my father, with some of the teachers, with my non-wrestling friends." It'd be a big jump in weight, up or down, I say. Yeah, he says, you got 2-3 really tough guys there. Yeah, we do. He shakes his head. Just hang in there. You need a ride? Nah, I want to walk. I do. I could have gotten a ride from Al or Kim or my father or just about anybody, but I want to walk. I want to get out of here. I want to think about winning the state championship, about destroying Al. See ya, I say, and start crossing the lawn. Franken's okay. He puts on wrestling clinics for the elementary school kids every year, which is how I first got into the sport. The school is down my end of town, but it's on the other side of Maine, a block up from the plant. I start walking up toward the other end, up the end where the hospital is and the Turkey Hill store, but I stay on Maple Street, block parallel to Maine. It's dark and quiet. I'm not going anywhere in particular, just away from what's behind me. Maple is above Maine as you climb the hill on this side, so you can look down on the stores and stuff. Sturbridge is almost like a stadium. There's a flat, two-block-wide valley down the spine of the town, then it rises up on both sides. It's a pit only the strongest crawl out of. I live on the hill on the other side from where I'm walking, across the Pocono River. Most of the homes are on the hills, with six blocks of stores and stone churches and a couple of bars on the flats, the traffic lights on either end define the business section. On the other end of town, behind me as I'm walking, is Route 6. Up beyond the other light, you cross the river again. It sort of snakes around the town, and Maine becomes North Maine. A section of bigger houses and bigger yards, some doctors and lawyers and families that go way back. Hatcher lives out there. Kim lives out that way, too. Both of her parents are elementary school teachers over in Weston, and they coach the swimming teams at North. It's a decent night, 52 degrees at 9:48. Kids who were at the match are already gathered down on Main. Rite Aid is still open. They do a good business in the half hour after a match. I walk into Turkey Hill, past the magazine rack and down the cupcake and potato chip aisle, toward the refrigerated section in the back. I stare through the glass door at the drinks, bottles of Hawaiian Punch and Pepsi and Gatorade, cartons of iced milk and tea and cans of Coke and 7-Up. After a minute, I take out a carton of orange drink and walk back toward the register, shaking the carton as I go. I have to wait behind a girl about 12, buying 17 magazines and a bag of popcorn, and a guy about 40 with glasses and a tie, carrying a giant styrofoam cup of coffee, the New York Times, a box of chocolate donuts, and a magazine. He has exact change, but it takes him a while to dig it out. I grab a straw and finish the orange drink before I even pay for it. Kim drives past as I come out of the store, but she isn't looking this way. Digits in the passenger seat, and I can interpret that several ways. I head toward Court Street because they'll be coming back along Maine any minute. Court runs parallel to Maine on the other side, hugging the river most of the way. I have this dumb idea of where I'm headed, and I let myself think it's because I'm still thirsty. The river moves faster along here. The drop in elevation isn't great, but it's enough to cause some rapids. So it's a different town here, just two blocks in from Maine, and it's dark and quiet and sleepy. Sometimes late at night I run through here, past the houses and the courthouse and the jail. The town's fast asleep between 1:30 and 6, and you can run through like you're in another dimension. I start walking a little faster when I reach Route 6, since I'm out in the open now. I just don't feel like seeing anybody connected with the wrestling team or the school or the whole town. I'll deal with them all later. What is it with Kim, anyway? I think she's got her head together too much for me to handle. She makes me want to find answers about myself, but I don't even know the right questions. I've had one girlfriend to speak of in my life. We started hanging around together the summer before our junior year, and Noreen Califano. I can't even look her in the face anymore. I was shy. I didn't really feel comfortable being with her, except in private. Our dates were football games that fall, and after the third one, I told her I didn't think it was working out. 2 weeks later, I started calling her on the phone again. I'd see her in school. She'd ignore me, but I'd call her as soon as I got home. And she'd be polite as can be, and sometimes we even had some decent conversations. And finally, I asked her to go to the movies. She'd have to drive because I didn't have my license yet, and she said okay. The next day, she said forget it. Her friends told her I was using her because she could drive, and no way should she lower herself after I dumped her for no reason. I kept calling, and she kept being okay to me on the phone. Then the year's first edition of The Lion's Roar came out. That's the school paper. I read the very first line in the gossip column for all the world to see. Urgent message from NC to Big Ben. Leave me alone. I laugh about it now. I reach the mobile station, and the girl is inside the office, talking on the phone. The older guy's at the pumps. I stick my hand in my pocket to keep all the change from rattling and go up to the door and look inside. She puts her hand over the phone and looks up and says, "Yeah?" "Could I get some change?" I say, waving a dollar. She opens a drawer and takes out 4 quarters, handing them to me and taking the dollar. The guy outside yells, "Jody!" And I see that there's 3 cars waiting for service. She says, "I gotta go," into the phone and hangs up. The vending machines are off to the side by the diesel pumps in an open, rectangular aluminum shed. 3 drink machines, Coke, Pepsi, and juices, and a food one with candy, pretzels, and stuff like that. I get a can of orange soda and a package of 6 Oreo cookies. Then I leave, because the girl's busy and just looks too beautiful for me. My father's not waiting up. My mother is home from work. I climb the stairs and hear them talking softly in their bedroom, their doors closed and the lights off. I close my door and lie in the dark on my own bed. It occurs to me that Digit and Kim may still be out driving around, or worse. I kick off my shoes. I'm empty. What I might be doing in a year. Wrestling at Penn State, wrestling at Western Community College, wrestling with my sanity. What I definitely won't be doing. Working at the plant, enlisting in the Army, joining the Boosters Association. I get a pass to the library on Monday out of study hall and pull out the yearbooks from the past few years. I finally find her in the graduating class of 2 years ago, Jody Mullins. I think I remember her vaguely, but not the way I see her now. In the yearbook photo, she looks different, repressed. Her hair is short, not flowing and full like it is now, and her face is rigid and squinty. Under activity, she's got band 1, 2, tennis 1, distributive education 4. There's no nickname listed. I flip to the section of candid photos and search in vain for another shot of her. I think I see the side of her head in a picture from the senior awards luncheon, but that doesn't tell me much, except she might have been there. I had hoped to discover that she was a wrestling groupie all grown up who still held some secret unfulfilled desires that maybe I could help with, but I haven't seen her anywhere except the mobile station, and I don't know if she's ever been to a wrestling match. I take the long way back to study hall so I can pass Kim's history class. I hang outside the door until I catch her eye, and she looks a little tentative but gives a smile and a tiny hesitant wave. I get back to study hall and sit next to Digit, who's reading Sports Illustrated. "We going to Hatcher's tonight?" I ask. "Yeah, I guess. We watch Monday Night Football there most weeks." "Run yesterday?" he says. "About 4 miles. Me and Al did 3. He closes the magazine and yawns. "Where'd you go after the match Saturday?" "Home. Where'd you go?" "Just hung around," he says. "You do anything?" "Drove around." He's not saying much, so I get more directed. "You put any moves on her?" Digit raises his eyebrows and sits up straighter. He says, "No," with no emphasis at all. "Oh, why would I?" he asks a little sharper. "Why wouldn't you?" He laughs. "Who do you think she was looking for all night?" I shrug, but that means I know. "She thought I was trying to help her find you, but I knew where you were the whole time. I kept telling her where to turn so we'd be sure to miss you." "How come?" "You obviously didn't want to get found." I nod my head. "So what did she say?" "She said she doesn't mind a chase if there's some chance of catching up, but she doesn't know what you're running from." He starts picking at a scab on his jaw where he cut off a zit shaving. He doesn't have much experience with a razor. "I don't know either," he says. I cross my arms and look at the ceiling a minute. Then I look back at Digit. "I'm too distracted, man." He looks at me like he doesn't know what I'm talking about, but I think he does. "It's because of wrestling. My whole life is built up to this season, and it might not ever happen," I say. "This is our year, my year. There's no more chances after this one." He stares right at me. "Yeah, so? I can't think about anything else right now. If I'm ever going to be anybody, it has to start this season." Digit knows this. We used to talk about it constantly. All 4 of us did. We'd imagine what it would be like to win the state, to be the best in Pennsylvania. Now it's staring us in the face, and it's scary. And it's worse for me, because I might not even get the chance. "I've never done anything worth a damn yet, Digit." He keeps staring at me a few seconds, then he grins. "You won that spelling bee in 4th grade. I laugh, and so he does too. "You guys at least have the chance," I say, getting serious again. "If none of us ever does anything, at least you guys will have something to hold on to." "True." I'm generally not one to complain. Digit's the only one I've said this to. I haven't even been facing it myself, but I guess I'm more desperate than I realized. He says, "One more thing. Don't blame Coach. This is about being the best, right? Al and Hatch are best where they are. If you want your chance, you have to take it. You have to beat one of us to get it. The bell rings to change classes, and we start walking toward the hall. So you ain't gonna move on her, I ask again? Only if you ain't gonna, he says. On Saturday night, the pep band debuts a song in Al's honor, You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon. They break into it as soon as Digit's match ends and strikes it up again the second Al executes his pin. This is the third match of the season, and nobody's lasted a full minute with him yet. Al does a kind of Michael Jackson moonwalk back to the bench, playing to the crowd and the band. The kid from Preston barely knew what hit him. Al had him on his back within 3 seconds and could have pinned him in less than 10. But Al likes to play with his food, so he pushed the guy around for 40 seconds before flattening him. The crowd was on its feet the whole time, yelling for blood, or at least pain. I take a deep breath and snap my headgear under my chin. Hatcher's moved up to 145 to get a better workout, so I'm finally out there for real at 140. I don't know when I'll get another opportunity, so I'm going to make this count. The guy I'm wrestling outweighs me by 5 pounds and has longer arms and legs. He's dark and hairier than most high school kids, and it looks like he's got some anger. But I'm from Sturbridge, and second-string Sturbridge is better than most first teams. Keystone Wrestling News has us ranked 4th in the state. I'm going to kill this guy. I have no quarrel with the smell of perspiration if it's clean, fresh, and salty, but this guy stinks. He shoots in immediately, and I dodge him easily and spring away. He shoots again, and this time I slip on the spot where Al had just pinned his guy. So I'm down, and he's got me, and I'm 2 points behind and in some trouble. He's got leverage, but not much, and I inch my way toward the edge of the mat. I'm not going to force my way out of this hold, so I need to get out of bounds. I'm used to this. Al gets me locked up uncountable times a day in practice, and I can usually keep myself from getting pinned, if not embarrassed. It takes most of the period, but I get to the edge of the mat, and I let him roll me to my back out of bounds. The ref blows his whistle, and my opponent is frustrated. He gets up and walks swiftly back to the center circle. I straighten my headgear and get down on all fours below him. I'm on my feet the instant the whistle blows, trying to force his hands apart where they're gripped around my waist. He lifts me to my feet and tries to throw me down, but I shift at just the right second and get free for an escape point. I pivot to face him, and he's already attacking. No letting up by this guy. We've got each other by the shoulders, circling around like grizzly bears in combat. He's slippery and exhaling in short, angry bursts. He lunges at me a couple of times, but I get out of the way. Between periods, the coach tells me to get in gear and attack this guy instead of waiting for him to make all the moves. Al puts his arm on my shoulder and says, "This guy is terrible. You should be killing him." I start the second period up, but the guy is strong, and I can't just muscle him to the mat. It takes me a while to finally take him down, and he escapes right away and gets to his feet. So now it's 3-3, and we're back in our dancing bear routine. The second period ends that way. The crowd is getting impatient. We won the first 6 weights by pin, and I hear some frustration as I walk back to the bench. Coach tells me to attack this guy, to get more aggressive, and stop playing around. Al puts both hands on my shoulders this time and says, "This guy's really terrible. You should be killing him." I start the third period down, and if I let him exploit that, he'll just ride me the rest of the match. He already has more than a minute of riding time on me, and if we end in a draw, the riding time edge would break that tie. The guy has one move. I should be kicking his butt. But I think I've forgotten how to win. All this time I've been learning not to lose, or at least not to get pinned. My offense has gone to heck. I rocket to my feet and break away pretty easily, and I can tell this guy's getting exhausted. I shoot in and take him down hard, and I hear the wind go out of him as he hits the mat. He's the one in trouble now, and he lets out a moan as I force his shoulders towards the mat. He'll neither get pinned or his arm will break, and after a few seconds of struggle, I feel him let go. The ref slams the mat with his palm, and I get to my knees. I let out my breath, and the ref lifts my arm, and I walk off the mat and slap hands with Digit. Coach shows me his fist and shakes it approvingly. Al pats my head and says, "That guy was terrible. It took you so long." Our program doesn't have the type of budget some of these top-ranked schools have, sending their teams to tournaments in Las Vegas and Chicago and Iowa. The biggest deal we get is an overnight trip to Allenstown for the Lehigh Valley Holiday Invitational. Of the 8 teams there, 3 of us are ranked nationally. Coach lets me go along, even though I'm not wrestling, and we win the title by 2 points over Phillipsburg, New Jersey, which USA Today has at number 6. Digit loses his first match of the season in the final to a kid from Maryland, but Al stays unbeaten by pinning a guy from Bethlehem on the day before Christmas. Hatcher wins too. We also finish ahead of Northampton, which, according to Keystone Wrestling News, was the best team in Pennsylvania. Not any longer. Coach sits up front on the bus ride home and brags to the bus driver about what a great team we have. It's only his fourth season here, and he figures he's got a lot to live up to. Digit spends most of the time staring out the window. He led going into the final period, but got taken down twice in the last minute. He says he learned something. I think he's the most likely of us all to win a state title this year because he's so intense. We still hang out most of the nights, but he heads home by 9. Me and Al and Hatcher usually sit on Main Street at least until Rite Aid closes. But Digit's drifting off. Even after a match, he doesn't quite let go. He keeps running it over in his mind. So he's even more distant today since he lost. He's not mooning anybody like Al and Hatcher and some of the others are. And on the ride home, Hatcher takes a red Pixie football out of his gym bag and tosses it at Billy, but it misses by 2 feet. It hits Anthony Terranova in the head. Anthony throws the football back at Hatcher, who grabs it and whips it back. This time it hits Billy. By the time we turn off the turnpike by Scranton, there's one cracked window, water all over the floor, and a couple of ripped seat cushions. Coach yells back at us to shut up for a while. Al starts singing Downtown Train, and Digit joins in. I go with Mom and Dad and Grandma to the 5 p.m. service on Christmas Day. I stopped at Kim's house for a few minutes just before. She gave me a tape of her psych-up music. I got her a ceramic whale. So we're driving to the church, and Mom asked me about her. I guess you two really like each other, she says. I guess. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I like her fine, but nothing seems to be happening. Seems like a nice girl, says Dad, who met her after the last home match. Grandma snorts. Me and Mom and Dad just look at each other and roll our eyes. We've reached the church. Jerry Franklin and his wife are the greeters. His wife winks at me and smiles a big toothy smile. Jerry gives me a light punch on the arm. We knocked off some big boys yesterday, huh? We're number one, I say. Kind of ironically, I think. It's hard to be bothered by this guy. See you Tuesday, he asks. Sure. School's closed this week. We're putting on a clinic at the Y for little kids. We sit in a pew and wait. I check my watch and it says 5:06. And I can see we're in for high comedy again. Reverend Fletcher and the wimpy youth minister, Paul Long, will show up in about 3 minutes, bursting through the door, singing Joy to the World at the top of their lungs. They'll be just so surprised to see the church full of people, having completely forgotten that they'd scheduled a service for this afternoon. We were out caroling, Fletcher will say, removing a red and white striped scarf. Did we schedule a service? Paul will say, looking at the little girl in the front row. She'll laugh and say yes. He'll turn to the reverend in surprise, and they'll say in spontaneous unison, "Well, then, let's have a service." Maybe you can sense that they've done this before. I heard them coming up the steps, and they're singing Hark the Herald Angels. Get me out of here. Things that I've mastered. Talking to myself, staring down an opponent, not getting pinned. Things I can't even do. Fly a kite, read music, figure out what girls are thinking. I walk down the hill to Al's house late Tuesday morning, crossing the footbridge over the river. The clinic's at noon. Al's father answers the door, and I step into the living room. I haven't been here in about a month. There's too much unspoken tension between me and Al. If Digit's around, it's easy to avoid, but one-on-one, it's almost impossible to ignore. Al has something I have to get, and there's no way to share it, even if we would. I can see him in the kitchen on the phone. His father points to the couch and tells me to sit down. He's wearing old stained work pants and a sleeveless white T-shirt. He's talking to Joe, he says, Al's brother. I think he's stationed in Texas. You off today, I ask? Yeah, he stretches out his left arm and yawns. I always take a day or two after Christmas. Coke or something? Orange juice? I just ate, but thanks. He straightens out some newspapers on the coffee table. He's got a cigarette smoldering and an ashtray on the table, too, but it looks like he forgot about it. The ash is about 2 inches long. Dad, Al's standing in the doorway with the phone. His father comes over and takes it and goes into the kitchen. Hey, Al says to me. Hey, you ready? Need my jacket. I follow him into the kitchen. His old man is laughing into the phone. Never a dull moment, he's saying. Al points to the kitchen table where there's a package of salami and some crackers. You hungry, he asks me. No, thanks. Al grabs his father's shoulder and says he'll be back for dinner. Tell Joe I'll talk to him again soon. We head down the walk, and Al pulls his gloves out of his pocket and puts them on. He looks over his shoulder at the house as we cross Court Street. My mom died 2 years ago, he says. 2 years today? Yeah, it's real hard on him, but he's doing okay. He seemed okay. Is that why your brother called? Pretty much. We try to stay close, yeah. We walk in silence for a few blocks. We have to cross back over the river to get to the Y, which is down the other end of town. Lots of kids signed up, Al says. I heard about 50. That's a lot of kids for the Y's small gym, but we'll squeeze them in. It's first, second, and third graders today. The older kids get their turn on Thursday. The gym is old. It used to be an armory, and if you're playing basketball, you can't shoot from past the top of the key without hitting a girder. But there isn't a kid in town who hasn't spent a lot of hours in there playing hoops or indoor soccer or floor hockey. The Y is in the far corner of town, where the river makes its right angle. We enter the gym, and about 20 little kids come running over to see Al, slapping five with him or just looking at him in awe. They don't ignore me either, but Al gets most of the attention. They even want autographs. Jerry Franken blows his whistle and tells everybody to sit in the bleachers. They hustle over, laughing and shoving, and Jerry goes over the agenda. Mostly we want them to have fun, to get a feel for the sport. Mostly they want to try and annihilate each other. We break into groups more or less by size. I've got mostly second graders, and we go over some basic moves for about 45 minutes. One really skinny kid named Cody keeps asking if they can do tag team matches, but I tell him that's just on TV. After a while, I let him and three others wrestle me at once. I let them pin me after a couple of minutes. I roll to my stomach, and they sit on my back. I reach around and tickle the skinny kid, sticking my thumb into his armpit. Then I tell him to go get a drink, and they all race to the water fountain. I look up, and Kim's standing by the entrance to the gym. I wave and go over. She's got a big smile. "They like you," she says. "I like them. What are you up to?" "I was lifting." She makes a muscle. I touch it with two fingers. "Nice crowd," she says. Two of the kids from my group come over. "That your girlfriend?" one of them asks. "Your lover girl," says the other one. I laugh. "Go do 100 push-ups," I say. "Yeah, right." They both laugh and walk back into the gym. Most of the kids from my group are out there wrestling in groups of 4 or 5. I turn to Kim and say bye. "Take it easy out there," I yell to the kids running over to the mats. I look back and Kim's still standing in the doorway. Al's group goes running for the water fountain next, and he's carrying two first graders piggyback. The kids are laughing their heads off. He gets over there and yells, "Help!" to Kim. "Peel these knuckleheads off me!" Kim takes one, and Al lets the other one down. Then he flops on the floor like he's totally out of energy, and four more kids pile on top. Franken blows his whistle and says it's time for the video. So everybody goes back to the bleachers, and Franken rolls in a big screen TV and a VCR. Somebody shuts the lights out, and we watch a highlight film from the past 2 seasons, including Al losing last year's state semifinal in overtime. Later, we hand out T-shirts and certificates, and the parents arrive to pick up their kids. The kids are all beaming and begging their parents to take them to our match on Saturday. A lot of them hug my legs, and one even kissed my hand. When I'm ready to leave, Al's sitting in the bleachers with Frank and deep in conversation. So I just catch his eye and say, "See you later." And they both yell, "So long." Jerry adds, "Thanks a lot." I step out into the sun and walk up toward Main Street, feeling like I've been bombarded with affection. It isn't a bad sensation. Where we stand, me at 135 versus Digit at 130. At present weights, I'd win 60% of the time, but dried out to 130, I'd lose 98%. Al 135 versus Digit 130, Al wins 95%. No reason for him to cut weight or for Digit to add. Hatcher at 140 versus Digit 130. Hatcher wins 98%, too much weight difference. Hatcher 140 versus Al at 135. Even giving away 5 pounds, Al wins 90%. If Hatcher cut to 135, it wouldn't even be competitive. Hatcher at 140 versus me at 135. At present weights, Hatcher wins 90%. If he had a reason to cut 5 pounds, I'd probably win half. Gaining 5 pounds wouldn't do me much good since the difference is all muscle. I don't have time to put on 5 useful pounds. Me versus Al. Well, stranger things have happened. In January, Kim called me on New Year's and asked me to go to her cousin's wedding with her a week later. Why not, I figured. Seeing a transplanted New York Puerto Rican marry a Pennsylvania dairy farmer would be an experience. So we're up at the Lackawanna Station Hotel in Scranton, drinking 7-Up at the bar and waiting for the reception to begin. The wedding was 6 hours ago, but they had to schedule things around the afternoon milking. We got lunch, saw a movie, and hung around town in between. It's easy to tell which of the guests are from which family. Aaron's family is enormous. Not that there's so many of them, they're just enormous individuals. One of his uncles is sitting 2 stools down from me, flirting with every one of Kim's female relatives that walks past. He's about 60 and wheezy, chain-smoking camels and with a powder-blue polyester leisure suit and a pistol in a holster that he's trying to show off while looking inconspicuous. I'll assume he's in law enforcement. The most attention he's drawn so far is from one of the Brooklyn aunts, a heavily lipsticked woman about his age who must think she's 25 and seems not to have realized that she's 40 pounds overweight. Kim, on the other hand, looks so beautiful I could die. We finally get into the ballroom and sit with Kim's parents, 2 aunts and 2 uncles and an old couple that's friends on the groom's side. Kim's father gets a pitcher of beer, partly for my benefit, but I go real easy on it. Kim sips white wine. They serve capons with stuffed potatoes and string beans. I'm sitting between Kim and her dad, so we talk about wrestling and track and swimming and how there's a lot of similarities. Being out there all by yourself with nobody to pass the ball or to run interference, you either win or you lose, and the degree to which either happens is totally dependent on you. Her dad has a coach's demeanor, but not like my coach. This guy is lean and limber with a dark mustache and short hair and a smile that's genuine. His wife is Kim's size and stylish. When the band starts, I squirm a little. They open with "We've Only Just Begun," and if they stick to that tempo, I'll be wishing they'd only just get finished. But they jump into "Satisfaction" and "Surfin' USA," and the dance floor fills right up. Kim starts tugging on my arm. Her parents are already up, and they dance pretty well. You can tell they really enjoy each other. I roll my eyes and take off my jacket. She grabs my hand and leads me out there, and I dance about as well as I can, which isn't good. They do twist and shout and light my fire, and I start working up a sweat. At the final crash of the drums, we all clap, and the lead singer announces a special request. I turn to walk off when he picks up his accordion, but Kim pulls me back. "You know how to polka, don't you?" she asks. Well, sure, I've seen it enough on TV. Somehow I don't feel like I'm dressed for it, but I find myself swinging awkwardly around the floor to the oompa beat. I should have expected this in Scranton. I have to admit that it's fun. Not that I'll be buying any polka tapes or anything, but bouncing around with Kim and feeling silly is a tolerable thing to do on a Sunday evening. We only stumble a couple of times. They take it down for "Wind Beneath My Wings," and my sweat suddenly turns cold. She reaches out her arms, but I wipe my forehead and nod toward the table. We walk off, close together but not touching. Kim looks a little surprised that I wanted to stop. Slow dancing doesn't take much effort after all. We sit down. "Your parents dance really good," I say. They're turning slowly, pressed against each other and gazing into each other's eyes. I feel like people are staring at me, but no one is. I think I know how those capons must have felt. Kim seems to sense my mood change. She gets up and says she's going to the ladies' room, and I say, "I'll go too." We start walking out. "You okay?" she says. "Yeah, fine. Why?" She shrugs. "Nothing, I guess." The pistol-packing guy in the powder-blue suit is at one of the urinals when I pull up. He's got a cigarette behind his ear, and he keeps clearing his throat. "Good party," I say. "Yep, lots of nice-looking ladies. Sure are." "Looks like you found one." "Yeah, I guess." "Oh, yeah," he says. I nod as if I do know what he means. I flush with my elbow. The guy is still using his urinal, at least standing there trying. "See you later," I say. "Yep," he says. Kim's parents sip coffee and talk to the other couples about work and their kids and other family things. I listen in fascination since I haven't spent much time around normal, well-adjusted adults. Kim's mom and dad sit close and he keeps rubbing her shoulder and they tease each other and smile a lot. The older couple, the ones who aren't from Kim's family, just got back from a month in Florida. The guy, Dutch they call him, has white hair and very ruddy skin. His wife, Ruth, is bigger than he is, though not by much, and amplifies everything he says with a high laugh. They raised 5 kids, have 18 grandchildren, and spend half the year traveling around in their motorhome to visit them. They were both born in Scranton and never left. I learned all this just by sitting there. What they didn't tell me was obvious is that they're best friends. My best friends are 3 guys who become my main rivals in varying degrees. Al and I may survive this season as buddies, but I'm feeling the strain. I want too badly what he has, and the only way to get it is to take it away. My hand is on Kim's knee all this time, and she's gently stroking it with her arm. She laughs a lot at what Dutch and Ruth have to say, especially when they talk about their littlest grandchildren. She grips my hand tighter when the band plays Just the Way You Are. After the cake and the bouquet throwing and all that, we get up to dance again. I'm tired. So is she. They play a couple of fast ones, but when they do Color My World and I hold her close for the very first time, she rests her head on my shoulder and shuts her eyes, and we sway back and forth and around. I run my hand along the back of her shoulder slowly, over her shoulder blades and down her side to her waist. Her bones are thinner, her muscles are smaller, but no less firm than the ones I struggle against every day in practice. Sometimes I wonder why I spend more time entwined with Al every day than I've spent in my whole life with any female. I guess because that's the easy part, the fighting, the physical stuff. You give everything you have, but it's all focused on you, all internal. You don't have to share, don't have to figure out the harder emotions, just the easier extremes. You're not trying to meld with somebody else, not trying to get close. I move my hand back up her side, over the shoulder, and down her spine, as low as I dare. Her dress is soft cotton, black, almost sweatshirt material, and clings to her body like a glove. She's wearing a necklace and diamond earrings. I kiss her on the tip of the ear, and she opens her eyes and smiles. She reaches up and kisses me on the mouth and puts her head back down and hugs tighter. The song ends. I don't know what I'm so scared of. She runs her hand up my back and we walk toward the table. I sit down and she sits on my lap. We came over with her parents, so of course we're driving back with them too. They sit closer in the front seat than we do in the back, and Kim and her mother both fall asleep. So I shut my eyes and lie back and listen to the radio all the way to town. Her dad sings softly to the classic rock. I wonder if he used to drive around with other kids and find stations to make fun of. They drop me off, and I shake Kim's father's hand, saying goodnight to her mother, and give Kim, who's awake now, a very quick kiss at about the level of her eyes. Of course, I'm wondering what might have been if we'd driven back from Scranton alone. I noted when we passed the bank that it was 17 degrees at 10:51. Warm summer evenings are too many months away. I open the door. I walk up the stairs and shut my door. I take off every piece of clothing and get under the covers, which, and call back the feel of her muscle, the soft smell of cotton, and I'm shivering. The guy I had tonight was slow and soft, maybe a 125er with 10 pounds of fat. I pinned him in 48 seconds. We won 10 of the 13 matches by pin and the other three by decision. Sturbridge, 69. West Pocono, 0. I sit in front of my locker for a long time, letting the music and the towel snapping and the yelling go on around me. I'm up to 3-0, but it's hard to stay sharp when you're only competing every other week. Plus, if the other team has anybody good at 135 or 140, then Al and Hatcher stay put. I only get out there against stiffs. I wrestled off with Al 2 days ago, and he beat me 10-3. I fell behind early and lost my drive, but the difference between us isn't as great as people think. I'm even starting to think I could take him. But this season is slipping away. If I'm lucky, I'll get 3 more dual meets, and that'll be it. A career that never was, unless I can get past Al. Digit's already dressed. I haven't even showered yet. You coming, he asks? Yeah, I say, and start taking off my uniform. Yeah. We're headed for McDonald's, everybody who can afford to gain a pound or two, to celebrate our new ranking. USA Today has us up to 8th nationally, with no other Pennsylvania schools in the top 10. Keystone Wrestling News will be out in 3 days, and we expect to be number 1 in the state. I shower in a hurry and find Hatcher and Digit and Al waiting in Al's car in the parking lot. I wasn't sure they'd still be around. Our foursome seems to be slowly dissolving. I've spent so many nights with these guys in the past 6 years that I could tell you everything they dream about, every girl they've been interested in, every time their father smacked them around. But I'm not sure we even know each other this season. I'm not even sure I know myself. Ever since junior high school, we've talked about winning it all, not just as a team, but as individuals, taking the state. Every time we'd lift weights, we'd be pushing each other, busting on each other, and making us work. Or we'd stand on Main Street in the evening, watching the traffic, always with wrestling on the edge of our consciousness, no matter what was going on. Being on top was a fantasy, but we were working our way into it, one workout at a time. Even last year, when these three guys were solidly on the varsity, I still was a part of it. But now I'm like a leper, watching from the outside. "Hey, man, we're number one," Hatcher says as I get into the car. "Looks that way," I say. "I was pretty worried tonight, though," Al says, not at all serious, especially after Coach gave us that pep talk. Coach had warned us about getting big heads, about letting down because the other team was winless. We knew better than that. "We should have lost," Digit says with a laugh. "Let the town go home crying for once." Al giggled. "We should do that next week against Wharton." "Get out," Hatcher says. "No way." "Not lose the whole match," Digit says. "Just scare 'em. The three of us will get pinned. We'd still win the match." "Coach would not like that," Al says, and he laughs. "But forget him. I'd do it if there wasn't so much at stake." "Number one ranking," Hatcher says. "Top 10 nationally," Digit offers. "Immortality for the rest of our lives," Al says. "And executive positions at the Cinder Block Factory." "Can't wait for that," Digit says. We pull into the McDonald's lot, and it seems almost like old times. We used to bust on our town every chance we got. The cops, who've got nothing better to do than clear us off the street corners. The men who labor every weekday at the plant and cap the workday at the bars, with us, a group of sweaty kids in leotards providing their only source of pride, the ex-wrestlers who get fat and never grow up, the oppression of the churches and the schools and the parents. For tonight, we're not taking part of that. We can stand back and laugh at it, but there's that feeling we all share, a feeling we don't quite give voice to, a feeling that grows stronger every day. We won't be high school wrestlers much longer. I guess we'd better enjoy it. Sunday morning, Mom and Dad and me and Grandma slide into the pew about three-quarters of the way back, behind two old ladies in blue coats and the Stockman family, five well-mannered blonde kids, all younger than 10, and a Mom and Dad who smiled too much. This week's message, I can't wait, is entitled Our Wayward Youth. There's a blurb on the back of the bulletin labeled The Philadelphia Story. It tells how the youth group is planning a three-day ministry in Philadelphia during Easter week, under the leadership of youth pastor Paul Long. I see that I'm listed as one of the 17 active members of the youth group, each of whom has a solid relationship with Jesus Christ. Now I know at least half of us are far from being active, but Grandma nudges me and points to my name, beaming. She should know better than that. I just look away. The service hasn't started yet. I look back and see the reverend in the hallway, just about ready to glide into the sanctuary. So I shove the bulletin into my pocket. I hurry to my feet as the organist starts the prelude, and I walk out past Fletcher and Long. Fletcher notices me and seems to flinch, a defensive reflex, no doubt. They can think I'm on my way to the bathroom, but I'm leaving for real. Just a lost, wayward youth checking out. I will never, ever return. Not in a million trillion years. I'm finished. On Wisconsin. We've only just begun. I am out of here. Kim's taking me out tonight. She asked and she paid. She picked me up in her mom's car after practice. We ate at McDonald's. Now she wants to play pool over at the Fun Zone. It's never crowded in here this early in the evening. Just some little kids with their parents burning off dinner at skee ball or video games. We get a table and rack up the balls, and I break, but don't sink anything. Kim walks completely around the table twice, looking for a shot, and I hold my cue kind of perpendicular to the floor and lean on it. You get to see girls from interesting angles when they're lining up a pool shot, and Kim is among the most interesting I've seen. She finally shoots, easing the three ball into a side pocket from a pretty tough line. She's got her tongue between her teeth as she lowers her head to table level, searching for her next shot. She misses, and I chalk up my cue and make a real solid stroke that sends about 10 of the balls flying, but don't sink any. Kim squeezes past me. She smells sweet. "Excuse me," she says. I've got my eyes fixed on her, but I guess they stray because I look up and notice the girl, Jody, the one from the mobile station, sitting over to the side with another girl about her age. They got a little kid with them, probably not even 2 years old, and he's playing on the floor at their feet. Jody keeps looking over at the entrance. After a few minutes, three guys come in, and she stands up. The one guy, who looks vaguely familiar, is maybe 3 years older than me and has longish hair and a cap that says Marlboro on it. He's about my size and has a thin, fuzzy mustache. He sees them and walks over and nods with a trace of a scowl. The other two guys leave. The mobile girl hands the guy the baby and says, maybe to both of them, long time no see. The guy holds the kid up and says, hey, buddy, sort of wiggling him while the kid's legs dangle. The baby looks back at Jody, reaching for her. It's okay, she says, gently taking the kid's finger. That's your daddy. I'm trying not to watch too closely, glancing around, looking at the pool table, but I'm hanging on every word. Jody's keeping an even tone, but there's enough of an edge to her voice that you could imagine what she's really thinking. "I left a message on your machine last night," she says. "Why didn't you call?" He just says, "I was out," not looking at her. "Daniel and I are leaving at 8, she says. "You said you'd be here at 6. "So what is it now, 10 after?" he says. "It's 7:15, she says. "We're leaving at 8. She turns to her girlfriend, and they start out the door. Then she stops and comes back to kiss the baby, who's starting to whine. "It's okay. You spend a little time with your daddy," she shoots a look at the guy. "We'll be over there in the pizza place, watching." The guy puts the kid down and takes his hand, and they walk over to the side where they've got rides for little kids. He lifts him into a rocket ship and feeds it a quarter, and it rocks back and forth while the kid spins the steering wheel. Kim pokes me on the arm with her cue. "You know those people?" I shake my head and look at the table. I've got stripes, and all 7 of them are still sitting there. There's only 1 solid ball left, and Kim is smirking at me. But I run the table, then sink the 8 ball with a long, clean stroke. Between every shot, I look over at the guy with the baby. The kid's happy now on his 3rd ride, and the guy just looks lost and bewildered. Kim looks beautiful, and a big part of me wants to tell her so. Another part of me, the part I can't quite measure, wants to pick up that baby and find the mobile girl, take both of their hands, and help them. The other part of me, the one that wins, makes me retreat inside, makes me shrivel, makes me wonder if I'll ever do anything that matters. Kim squeezes my arm and looks up at me. Not many people can look up at me, but she's short enough and says, "Rack 'em up." I start to say, "No, I'm tired," but I know that isn't true, so I say, "Yeah, I'll play another game. It's healthier than playing games in my head." Kim deposits a quarter to release the balls, then spends about 2 minutes racking them up, rearranging them about 15 times. I can see the guy sitting outside now with a cigarette, staring straight ahead, holding the baby on his knee. The kid is playing with the buttons on the guy's shirt, and the guy doesn't seem to realize that he's blowing smoke in the kid's hair. Kim sinks one on the break, but doesn't leave herself much of a second shot. I sink 5 in a row before she shoots again, and I win on my next turn. I haven't said a word in 10 minutes. "You're good," Kim says. I nod. "Sometimes." I force a smile on her, too, and start digging in my pocket for another quarter. The moon is nearly full, and there's the slightest dusting of snow on the ground. The air is cold, but there's no wind, so the only sound is the frozen leaves crunching lightly under our feet. My dad has a flashlight, but he hasn't turned it on. The last thing he said was back at the house when he asked if I wanted to come along. I nodded and put on a hooded sweatshirt and gloves. Mom's working tonight. I knew something was up, and I guess he knew that I knew. We're headed for the houses by the pond, through the woods, about a half mile above our house. There are maybe 2 dozen little houses there. Most of them aren't even winterized, and nobody lives in any of them except during the summer and the occasional weekend. My dad does maybe 3 jobs a year up there ever since he was in high school. Once every year or two, he takes me along, silently passing along a heritage that started with his own daddy. The trees are tall back there, maples and white pine. We're high enough that I can see the lights of Sturbridge far below us, and I can see my breath. My dad has his black and red checkered hunting jacket on and a dark blue watch cap pulled low. He's carrying a small cloth sack with a drawstring. There's a dog barking way down below, and my lips are dry. We come to a clearing above the pond. He stops. The pond is 2 football fields wide and 3 times as long. Tonight, it's as black as coal, except where the moonlight shines like a mirror. It's frozen solid. Below us is a small beach with 2 low docks jutting out of the water. On the far end of the pond is a Boy Scout camp, and lining either side are the cottages, owned by people from Brooklyn and Philadelphia and New Jersey. I've been inside a couple of them on other nights like this. "That red one," he says, and I wonder if he's been there before. I figure he must have hit all of these places at one time or another, but maybe he has his favorites. We start walking again, keeping our distance from the water and coming up behind the house. There's a dirt road that circles the pond, and we walk it for about 50 yards. All the houses are dark. This one has a low rock wall that runs from the road to the water, lining one end of the property. I know the house. It's small and squarish, with a big picture window that looks out on the pond and a cinder block chimney on the side. There's maybe a half cord of wood stacked against the house, which is a muddy red clapboard. My father tries the door then walks to the window near the chimney. It doesn't take much to get the window open, and he climbs in and motions me in after him. The house smells musty from being closed up since summer. He clicks on the flashlight and puts his hand over the light, running it slowly around the room. We're in the kitchen, so he opens some cabinets and finds a few cans of soup and a jar of spaghetti sauce, nothing we'd want. He carefully shuts the cabinets and looks around. The inside of the refrigerator smells sour and moldy, so I shut the door as soon as I open it. He takes a small clock radio from a bedroom and also a hammer and a couple of fishing lures from the room next to the kitchen. We leave the clothing and the blankets and the books, which include Cannery Row and Roger's version. Dad says he's already read them. I reach for the flashlight. My father lets it go. I shine it on two portraits in the tiny living room, hung together in a cardboard mat with two openings. The one on the left is Elvis in his youth with slick black hair and a cocky smile. The other is the standard painting of Jesus you see everywhere. In a faint hand, someone had scrawled, "You give me strength," in blue pencil on the cardboard. We go back to the kitchen, and my father pulls open a drawer next to the sink. He finds 80 cents and two bottle openers. He holds up the openers, determines that they're exactly the same, and slips one into the sack. The other one goes back in the drawer. "Been needing one of them," he says, holding the sack open and studying the contents. He bites down on his lip and looks up at the ceiling. "Last time I was here, I was 24 years old. Got a jackknife and two cans of motor oil." He rubs his chin, dark and scratchy with 2 days' growth. "Did better this time, I'd say." We leave by the same window. He never does any damage. Wouldn't even leave a drawer ajar, so it's likely that the owners will never know we were here. They'll look at each other one evening next June and wonder if they hadn't left a clock radio in that back bedroom, and old Sam will be confounded by what could have become of his hammer. My father's good at this, so good that it's invisible to everyone but me, like a ghost spanning the decades, revisiting the past as he revisits old trespasses. It's his secret, and he shares it with me alone. We move real quickly, getting back to the trail through the woods, and my father lets out a triumphant little laugh when we finally reach safe ground. "You ever worry about getting caught, Dad?" "Not much. Got it down to a science." He puts a hand on my shoulder, and we slow our pace. He shrugs and laughs again, feeling giddy and renewed, I suppose. There's an envelope sticking out of my locker when I get to school. It's a Valentine from Kim. I look at my watch. Yes, it's February 14th. It's 7:58. Rite Aid opens in 2 minutes and homeroom begins in 7. I can make it. I sprint out the door and down the hill, through the alley next to the bagel place and into the drugstore. I scan the cards and grab one with two rabbits on it. "Honey Bunny, won't you be mine?" and race to the register. The store has only been open for a minute and a half, but there's a lady at the checkout with two bottles of shampoo, a box of Motrin, four jars of Jergens facial soap, a tube of Crest and an ironing board cover. Oh, and four coupons. Two of the coupons have expired, and a discussion begins. It's 8:04. I throw $2 on the counter. The card costs $1.25, and I sprint out the door. Mrs. Corcoran shoots me a look as I get in a minute late, but she doesn't say anything since I'm usually prompt. Digit reaches over and takes the card and gives me a big grin. "I love you, too," he says. "I'll give you your present later." "Give me that," I say. "That's for Al." This is a huge day for me, not because it's Valentine's Day, but because it's Wednesday, wrestle-off day. I'm 6-0 this season for real, but 0-8 in wrestle-offs. I think I finally got him figured out, though. Last week he beat me 7-3, but I was actually ahead 3-2 midway through the second period, and he hasn't pinned me in a month. Al and Hatcher are ranked first in the state in their weight classes, and Digit is rated third at 130, and none of those guys is significantly better than I am. I have been watching and waiting for a long time, getting my little matches, but gearing up for something monumental. The bell rings it for first period, and I go looking for Kim. Then I remember I haven't even opened her card. I tear open the envelope and skip the verse. She wrote Ben on top and signed it Love, Kim. I just signed Ben on hers. I keep a tight rein on my emotions. I shut my eyes and wipe the sweat from my face, getting a grip on my nerves. I'm so psyched I feel little explosions going off in my arteries, but I have to keep thinking clearly. I'm ahead, 5-3, and I took Al down twice in the first period. He escaped the first time and took me down, but I managed to get free. Then I shot in and took him down again. I think I've got him rattled. Coach waves me to the center circle. I start the period down. Very few people can survive from this position against Al, but I'm ready. Coach blows the whistle, and I force my way up, loosening his grip and escaping. We circle around each other, and he keeps reaching for me, but I stay clear. Then I shoot in and grab his ankle, and he's down on his stomach, and I have control. I'm destroying him. It's 8-3. Who's number one now? He escapes quickly and takes me down, but I drag him out of bounds. I've still got the lead and the momentum. I escape. 9-6. I take him down again. I've solved this man. I'm ruining him. It's 11-6, and he's in trouble. I'm rolling him to his back, rolling just too far, losing control, and he reverses me. It's 11-8, but the period's almost over. 11-8, and I know I can hold on till the whistle blows. I don't succumb. I'll start the third period up. I've taken him down 4 times in this match, and I doubt that anybody's ever done that to him, not even when he was a freshman. The third period begins. Make that 5 takedowns. He's down. I'll win this thing today. I'll ride in the whole period, and I'll never look back. He's slippery. His muscles are smooth and sweaty and strong. Somehow he gets loose. Somehow he gets to his feet and shoots in and puts me on my back. Somehow I'm ahead only 13-11, and he's got control. Coach is hovering beside us, head against the mat, watching for a pin. But I will not be pinned. I'll get out of this. And I do, but not completely. I get off my back, but can't quite escape. And he gets 3 near-fall points and the lead, and that's as far as it goes. 14-13, the closest I've been in years. I take off my headgear and shout, "Dang!" so the whole school can hear it. I had it. I had him beat. "Relax, Benny," Coach says. "What's your problem?" I kick my headgear to the side of the mat. "I had him, Coach," I say. "I had him beat." Coach waves me over. Al's at the water fountain, and the 145-pounders are waiting to wrestle. Coach puts his hand on my shoulder. "You feeling all right?" he asks. "Just mad." "At who?" "At myself. I had him beat, Coach. I had him beat." Coach sort of smiles. "You wrestled good," he says, "but don't get bent out of shape, kid. It wasn't like you think." I'm still seething. What wasn't? He needed to work on reversals. The state meet's coming up, and he hasn't had enough challenges. Not many people ever take him down. Not like I did. Right, not like you did. He needed 4 or 5 opportunities under real live conditions. We talked it over before the match. Suddenly, I get the picture. All the life goes out of me. I stand frozen on the mat, staring at the wall. "He's the best in the state, Ben," Coach says softly. He puts his arm around me. "Get yourself a shower." I head for the locker room. Al and Hatcher are wrestling on another mat, laughing and straining. Digit is refereeing. I walk down the stairs like a zombie. I open my locker, put my clothes in my gym bag, and put my coat on over my wrestling stuff. I take the bag and lock the locker. I walk home real slow and unlock the house. Mom's already at work, and my father hasn't gotten home yet. I go to my room and set the gym bag on the floor, taking off my wrestling shoes and turning off the light, and curl up on the bed with 2 fingers against my lips and my eyes open wide in the darkness. I don't know how long I lie there. Eventually, I fall asleep. When I wake up, my father's standing over me with his hand on my forehead. "You okay?" he says. I open my eyes. "Yeah, getting a cold, maybe." "You eat anything?" "No. What time is it?" "About 8:30. "Okay, I'll get something soon." He goes back downstairs. My lips are dry, and I am thirsty. My eyes sting a little, but I never stay sad for long. My sadness is already turning to anger. No way is it ending like this. I watch the match against Midvale from the end of the bench in street clothes. We win big, as expected, wrapping up a 16-0 dual meet season. All that remains is the league meet and the state tournament. I want to get home. I've barely spoken to anybody all day. Digit said good match yesterday to me in homeroom, and I told him to shut up. I think he meant it, though. He wouldn't bust my chops about that. I head for the exit, and I hear Kim call my name pretty sharply as I stop and turn. I avoided her all day. She comes over. "What's up?" she says. "Not much," I answer. "You going home?" "I was." "You said you'd call me last night." I let out a sigh and start chewing on my lip. I wasn't feeling very good. Still could have called. We're in people's way, so I step against the wall. I got my butt kicked again in the wrestle off, I tell her. I needed to be alone. She stares straight ahead and starts to say something, then stops. And she starts again. You know, every time you have a bad match, you head for the door like a racehorse. When things are going good, you're only too happy to see me. When you have a little problem, you act like I'm a pain in the butt. No, I don't. Like heck you don't. What am I, your cheerleader? I only get to come close when you want to feel like a hero? I don't want to feel like a hero. No, what do you want, Ben? You don't seem to want me. Yes, I do. Not bad enough. Maybe as an ornament. I look away, and two little kids are wrestling out of the mat, and several groups of adults are standing around talking. The guy from the newspaper is interviewing Alan, the coach. It was the worst wrestle-off of my life, Kim. The worst match I could imagine. What does that have to do with me? Nothing. Everything. I don't know. I'm sorry. She studies me for a few seconds, probably wondering how she got hooked up with such a wimp. Okay, she finally says. I roll my tongue over my left molars and look at the floor. Then I look at Kim. She squints at me and I touch her nose with one finger. My feet are cold and my head is hot. I feel like I'm going to throw up. One of her friends is standing by the door. She gives Kim a look like, are you coming or not? You going home? Kim asks me again. Yeah, I say, I really do feel bad, okay? Okay, she smiles and puts two fingers on my lips. You jerk, I'll see you tomorrow. Happy Valentine's Day. And then she's gone. I wasn't there, but I can envision it clearly. I know the procedure. I've been there. Winter in northeastern Pennsylvania is cold. The temperature falls to the teens in January and hardly ever gets out for at least 8 weeks. Most nights it hits single digits. The furnace generates a lot of heat every night, keeping the school warm for us students. Picture Al with a six-pack, a not-so-unusual occurrence. He's driving around after practice with two other guys and two other six-packs. They get to talking about their English teacher, a prissy, balding guy in his 30s who still lives with his mom. They don't like him much. The school's open. Adult education class is going on downstairs, so they park the car and slip inside and make their way up to the classroom. This was Tuesday, about 8 p.m. It was already down to 14 degrees. If you pour water on a radiator that's going full blast, then shut the classroom door tight, you'll have a pretty healthy odor in there in the morning. It bakes on good. You can even wait 15 minutes or so for the first layer to get sticky, then add another coat. Leave in a hurry and don't make much noise on your way out. If you're on the wasted side, you might get a little carried away. You might laugh uncontrollably, loud enough for somebody walking the halls to be alerted. If that guy happens to be the vice principal, you're nailed. Now, Mr. Frazier is a decent man. He's a wrestling fan. He knows that the league meet starts on Friday, and he can take a joke as well as anybody. But there's witnesses here. Can't strike a deal, even for the good of the program. All three guys have to go down together. Damn lucky it didn't happen next week. Next week is the districts. You miss districts, your season's over. Missing the league meet is survivable. It's a three-day suspension, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. If you don't wrestle in Friday's qualifying round, you obviously can't wrestle Saturday. Coach tries to make a deal, but there's no way out of this one. The official word is a violation of school rules. I'd love to see that rule in writing. Al sits home, missing 3 days of school and practice. The entire town is alerted. If this was district week, there'd be a lynching. I get to wrestle in the league meet. The Keystone Wrestling News High School Rankings for February. Sturbridge, number one, won 58th consecutive dual match. Al Phillips at 135 and Anthony Hatcher at 140 remain unbeaten. Cannonsburg ranks second. Northampton is third. Nazareth is ranked fourth. Mechanicsburg is number five. Altoona Central, number six. Easton, number seven. Penn Hills is eighth. Reading Eastside is ranked ninth. And Johnstown is ranked 10th. I am seated second behind Arnie Kiefer of Laurelton, who's ranked fourth in the state and is the only guy in the league Al didn't pin this season. In fact, he gave Al the only close match he's had all year, 8-5 at their place back in January. I wrestled him last year, and he pinned me in the first period. If I meet him at all, it won't be until the final tomorrow. Tonight, I've got a short guy with giant arms from Mount Ridge. Matches are going on two mats, since they've got to get through four bouts in every weight class tonight. Our stands are packed, but people have been noticeably quiet during the early matches. There are a lot of mad adults who can't believe what happened to Al, who's like the second coming of Jerry Franken, at least. Coach took some heat, but I think most people are convinced that he's not at fault. They realize he stood with unflinching valor in Al's defense, but lost. I'm catching some cold looks as I warm up, as if I'm somehow to blame for not being Al. Folks, I'm 6-0. I'm in the greatest shape of my life, and I'm hungry. Forget Al for 2 days. He'll survive. I get out on the mat and we shake hands. This guy's arms, I may have mentioned, are out of proportion, long and thick and heavy. So his thighs are skinny and he's got no butt. His hair is short and light. The ref blows the whistle and I shoot really low under those arms and grab him about the knees and I put him down. I twist him around and drive him toward the mat, but he's helpless and outclassed and in trouble. 23 seconds, and he's fried. I barely worked up a sweat. I unsnap my headgear, shake his hand, and without looking at him, retreat into the locker room. I've got the guy from North in the semifinals tomorrow afternoon. I want no contact with anybody until then. We advanced all 13 weights into the semis. No other team moved more than 8. The team title looks like a lock. The crowd seems more relaxed today, looser and louder. The Al thing may have been forgotten for now. Tommy Austin made the final at 103, and our guys have also won semis at 112 and 125. Digits finishing up his semi right now. He's got a big lead, but it doesn't look like he'll pin the guy. Coach hasn't said anything to me except to do the best I can. I just nodded. I stayed awake most of the night listening to the radio and finally fell asleep about 3. But I'm not tired. Every muscle feels wide awake, energized. I'm up next. Al is sitting on the bottom row of the stands wearing his Letterman's jacket, which he almost never wears. He's got his chin in his hand, watching intently but not saying much. He's sitting with some football players, but I saw him come in alone. He brightens just a little when I catch his eye. He's got his hair combed. The guy from North is taller than I am, which is not in his favor. I'm compact. I've got a low center of gravity. Tall, thinner guys never do well against me. This guy's dead meat. He's got straight dark hair and eyes that are too close together. His hands are big and sweaty, and he can't seem to get a grip on me. When I throw him to the mat, his air rushes out and his cheeks get red and blotchy. The ones who shut their eyes are, as you twist them, never seem to recover. The end comes 55 seconds into the match. Coach puts his arm around me as I walk off the mat. Good one, he says. You can win it all, you know. I know. I grab my squirt bottle and take off the headgear. Hatcher pats on my shoulder. Digit shakes my hand and won't let go. Al was supposed to give you 3 takedowns, then pin you, you know, he says. Think about it, Ben. He couldn't do it. Kim intercepts me on the way to the locker room. Hey, stud, she says, and I probably turn red. I smile. Hey, I say. You're not wasting my time, are you? No, I reach to scratch myself, but stop. Tonight's a different story. These first 2 guys were lame. See you after? I'll try. I give her a weak smile, then turn away. The only thing in my head for the next 4 hours should be Arnie Kiefer of Laurelton. We have 9 wrestlers in the finals. The pep band is in its finest form, unrolling all of its hits and debuting the theme from Rocky. Every seat is full, and lots of people are standing against the walls. I'm sitting next to Digit, and we can barely hear each other talk. I'm not saying a whole lot anyway. Tommy Austin wins at 103, the first freshman league champion in 16 years. We get seconds at 112 and 125, and Digit pins his guy in the 3rd period. He's now 24-1. It gets a little quiet now. People are remembering that 135 ought to be the biggest lock of the tournament, unbeaten Al on his home mat for the last time of his career. Kiefer is one of these guys who looks bored and vicious at the same time, like a junior Marine officer, cold, clear eyes, square jaw, tight mouth he never seems to open. He seems bigger, wider than a 135-pounder. The guy is 21-1 this season. Al just outsmarted him in January. 3 images whip through my mind in the seconds before the start. Reverend Fletcher, pale and paunchy, telling me about the evils of wrestling. Foolish, he called it one Sunday last September. Mean-spirited and aggressive. This crowd, just minutes ago, rising to its feet and exulting in little Tommy Austin, the emerging hero, the man who'll carry this town through the next 3 cold winters, and me, staring at the ceiling last night in the darkness, imagining what the coming few minutes would offer. I'm out there. The match starts. I hear Digit's voice above the others. This man is strong, stronger than Al, I'm certain, but not as quick, not as slippery. He's harder to move, but easier to control when you do. He's beatable. He pinned me a year ago, when I was still in awe about wrestling varsity, scared of this guy's limited reputation, unable to let myself go. Tonight, I let it go. Tonight, I let the crowd's rising crescendo carry me. I take him down, and my energy level seems to triple as the crowd roars its approval. I feel excitement in my muscles, the power of 1,000 screaming voices. I feel strength I've never had before, and I feel this guy wilting beneath me. 37 seconds and he's pinned. Wham! I raise both fists above my head. I shut my eyes and feel holy. Coach rushes out to meet me and Digit and Hatchet embrace me. I look to the stand, zero in on Al. You're next, sucker, I say, thrusting a finger in his direction. He looks stunned and then angry. He scowls and makes a slapping motion with his hand. Later, they give me the most outstanding wrestler trophy, 3 first period pins. First minute even. He won 7 finals. or we won 7 finals, including 5 straight from 130 to 152. The locker room is a madhouse. Hatcher is on top of the lockers throwing balls of wet toilet paper at people. The music's on full volume and Digits dancing outside the shower. Coach comes up to me and says, "That was a great way to cap your career, Benny. Really nice. One more, I say, at least." "Come on," he says with a smile. "Don't spoil it. You know better." I shake my head, but I don't push the issue. He can't stop me from wrestling off with Al on Wednesday, and he knows it. I'll deal with that later. Right now, I'm 2 up. Al comes in eventually and looks at my trophy. "What was that?" he says, meaning my action after the match. "This won't bring me down either." "Nothing," I say, but I meet his eyes for once. "Nothing personal." "I'll kick your butt," he says, leaning against my locker. "Might," I say, "might not." "I'll destroy you in front of everybody, pal," he says. "Don't even bother." Keeper thought so, too. "Keeper's terrible. He's nothing. You won't last 30 seconds with me, Ben." I don't like this much. Me and Al have been friends for 6 years. I'm as good as I am because I've been wrestling him every day, but that cuts the other way, too. He starts to walk away, looking straight ahead and jabbing his hands into his pockets. "I'll kick your butt," he says. And it comes to me. Now, Al's scared. He may be the best high school wrestler in the state. Everybody who knows seems to think so. I think so, too, but there's one guy left who can take him. One guy who really believes he can do it. And that guy used to be Al's best friend. I get dressed in a hurry and go looking for Kim. She's waiting in the hallway. This time, I'm glad to see her. For the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. That's what it says on the stone above Giles Green. I'm reading it while Kim tightens her shoe. She's got on black running tights and a light blue sweatshirt with the hood down and big gray mittens. It's the first day above freezing in at least a month. There's been hardly any snow this winter, and so the ground is firm and bare. She stands up and starts running again. Most of my friends won't run in the cemetery because of some general dread of death. I think it's the most peaceful place in town, a great place to work out or just walk through and think. It's in the wooded hills on the far side of the river with blue spruce and hemlocks and some giant white pines. We run on dirt paths between the graves surrounded by names of families that died out a century ago. Penwarden, Farnham, Tibbetts, the name of families I see every day. Tryon, Kimball, McFarland. Last night, me and Kim and Digit just hung out on Main Street after the match, talking about little things like TV shows or where we might get jobs this summer, and the whole time my mind was trying to figure out how to do it, how to beat Al in the wrestle-off. And I went to sleep last night knowing I would do it, and I woke up this morning knowing that I wouldn't. We curve around past an old family plot with a low metal fence, just foot-high posts with a railing, and run uphill toward the Civil War area. There's a ring of gravestones there, maybe 2 dozen. Sometimes in the summer we'd take Pabst Blue Ribbon from Al's refrigerator and sit among those stones at night looking up at the stars. Those were always good times. We never get rowdy in the cemetery. We'd just sit there and talk about our fathers, why we love them and why we hate them, why we do anything in our power to avoid being like them and somehow knowing that we already are. Kim stops to read one of the stones. "John Baker, Company C," she says. "Company C, I guess." She bends over to look at another, and I'm taken by the view of her as she kneels down. "This one was a corporal," she says. "Jazz Northcott." There's lichen on all these stones. Some are cracked and chipped. We head down the hill, not saying much, just taking it in the piece. She runs faster down the gentle slope, opening her stride and moving away from me. I can never run that gracefully, that effortlessly. Even sprinting now, she looks so smooth, like a doe pulling away from me, or a dancer, her dark hair bouncing on her shoulders. She circles back to me after a minute, panting but smiling. "Sorry," she says, "I just felt so good. I had to take off." "No problem," I say, falling back in step with her. "You look strong." "Yeah, thanks," she says. "I love to run fast, just to let everything go. I can't wait to start racing this spring." We keep running, sticking to the older section, making half-mile loops on the paths. The newer section is flatter and less wooded, less interesting. I found my grandfather's stone in there last summer, my father's father. He died when I was little, and nobody ever took me to the grave. It says he fell asleep in the arms of Jesus, but that isn't the way I heard it. My mother says she never saw the guy without a drink in his hand. I guess that's an exaggeration, but I see your point. Kim drives a little harder up a hill, but jogs in place at the top to wait for me. "I love it in here," she says quietly, almost at a whisper. "I feel so connected with the past. It makes me feel so alive." At the bottom of the slope, she stops to look at another stone, a big one. This guy was a doctor, she says. Samuel E. and Lucretia B. Dunning, died 1877-1881. She drops to her knees and looks at the smaller stone behind it, squinting to read the faded words. Our Charlie, June 21st, 1862, January 3rd, 1863. Oh, that's so sad. She stands and takes a step toward me, still staring at the little stone, and slowly brushes her hair back from her forehead. I'm struck by the simplest of thoughts, how real Kim is. Real to me, I mean. Not like the images I've had in my head of other girls, of Jody, the mobile girl, of girls I'd watch in school or on the street, or even Kim up to this point. The sun goes behind a cloud, and I walk over to Kim, who's studying a marker from 1844. Another simple thought. This one I say out loud. This seems like a good place to be 100 years from now, don't you think? Nothing really left but some lines etched in stone. Kim looks up at me, just gazing at my face. Makes you think, she says softly, about what has to come first. I put my hand on top of her head and tap her gently with my fingers. She leans forward slightly and rests her forehead on my chest, and I don't say what I'm feeling because it seems premature, but I let out my breath and rest my chin on her head and let my arms drop down around her shoulders. We stand there like that for a couple of minutes, silent. The workout's over. Kim raises her head, and we walk back toward town, toward the future. It's Wednesday. I wrestle Al this afternoon. Winner goes to the districts. The other guy goes home. I meet Kim at lunch, and we walk down the Main Street deli. There are some booths there, so we get sandwiches and sit down. I stare at my chicken salad on a hard roll with lettuce and tomato, and she says, I better eat or I'll be weak later. I take a deep breath and one bite. That's how I felt before the states and cross country, she says. I couldn't eat. I didn't sleep the night before. She makes me look up at her. I came in 146th. I pick up a chunk of the chicken from my plate and eat it. There's a pretty big crowd at the counter now, so it's a good thing we got here early. Mostly kids from school, a couple of lawyers, and some secretaries. You want to know why I punched that minister? She raised her eyebrows a little and nods. So I tell her. Me and my father were coaching a team in this Sunday afternoon little kids soccer program. Our church put it on, but anybody could play. We had a team in the first and second grade league. Reverend Fletcher was one of the other coaches. Four teams, you play everybody else twice. The idea was to have fun and learn something. No standings or statistics, purely instructional. Everybody plays an equal amount and everybody rotates positions. So we're 1-2-1 after 4 weeks, and we're going against Fletcher's team, which is 4-0 and has clobbered everybody. He took all the best players for his team when he made up the rosters. Plus, he knows the game, played in high school and all. No big deal, right? It's just for fun. Anyway, after three quarters, we're actually ahead 3-2. We've got 8 on each team, but it's a small field, and you only play 5 at a time. Our best kids have already played 2 quarters, and so have his. So we send our subs back in. He's got his guys huddled up on the sideline. There's only about 10 yards away from us, and we hear him telling these kids that if they don't win, then nobody goes to the fun zone afterward. Then he sends his best players back onto the field. They score 4 more goals, and we never even get the ball past midfield. Now, it isn't that we lost. The kids aren't even upset about it. They just love to play. All the kids shake hands, and he comes over to us to do the same. He takes my hand, and I say something like, "That wasn't exactly fair to our guys." He keeps hold of my hand and frowns, then grips it a little tighter. I'm not smiling when I ask, "Does it really mean that much to you?" "Don't be a poor loser, Ben," he says. And I tell him to screw himself. He shoves me away from him, and my father steps forward and sticks an arm between us. The Reverend is standing there, kind of defiantly, holding his ground, and a couple of parents who've been watching are inching their way over. I hold my ground, too, and I tell him he's one heck of an example for these kids. "Darn right I am," he says. And then he calls me a pansy. Now, I don't think anybody's actually used that as an insult in the past 3 or 4 decades, but I catch his intention. So I step forward again, right in his face. He's about 5 inches taller than me, but you know what I mean. "Step back, son," he says. I move about 2 inches closer. He shoves me with both hands, and I go at him swinging. It's over in a second, but I hit him once in the gut and a real solid right to the mouth that draws blood. I don't think he hit me at all. My father and some other guys drag me away, but I shake loose and just walk toward the car. My father catches up and doesn't say anything right away, just walks alongside me, looking back once or twice. When we get in the car, he sighs and grips the wheel and nods at me nonstop for about 30 seconds. He punches me gently on the arm. I'm still seething, and he says, "Well, let's get home." He starts the car, and we're out of there, and he's got a hint of a smile he's trying to hide. and he's never mentioned it again. Kim's got her arms folded kind of tight, and she's looking at me like she doesn't quite get it. But she's got that same hint of a smile that my father had, and I don't think I've ruined her image of me. So, she says, can you call back enough of that anger to help you this afternoon against Al? I'm not sure I have any of that anger left, I say, but I don't have to look too far to find more. I can set off when I need to. Why do you need to? She unfolded her arms. I'm not sure that I do, but I still have plenty, plenty of anger, frustration. I reach my hand across the table and put it on top of hers. I squeeze her hand gently and look in her eyes, and she smiles kind of stoically. Why don't you pull all that anger in one little package and take it out onto the mat with you today? She says, and use it all up, every ounce of it. Then, win or lose, walk away and move on. I withdraw my hand, but not my eyes, and I smile and let out my breath. Then I start eating what's left of my sandwich, and she puts her foot on top of mine under the table. I put down the sandwich, wipe my mouth on my sleeve, and go around to her side of the booth where I sit right against her, put my arm around her, probably getting chicken salad that I just wiped off my mouth on her shirt, and I kiss her really nice on the lips. Now, how am I going to get angry again by this afternoon? They've moved the wrestle-offs to the main gym, and they've had to let the bleachers down on both sides of the court because of the crowd. In my 4 years here, I've never seen more than 15 spectators at the wrestle-offs. Today, there must be 700. Al's already out there warming up, but we won't be wrestling for about 20 minutes. I'm sitting in front of my locker with my sweatshirt hood pulled up and just staring at my hands and exhaling pretty hard. I've got a scar on the back of my left hand, barely visible, unless you know where to look. It's from when I ripped it open playing kickball on the playground in third grade. Fell face first, heading for second, but the only injury I remember is my hand. You could see bone at the knuckles. I lie flat on the bench, clenching my fists. The ceiling in this locker room is high, and we get big clouds of steam bouncing around up there after practice when all the showers are going. Somebody years ago must have climbed on top of the lockers, took a pen, and wrote "Sturbridge sucks" on the ceiling in the corner. Maybe it was my father. There are people who've asked me to concede this match, to not even wrestle. Why stand in Al's way? They want to know. Why risk him getting hurt? There are a few people who want me to win, though. Some guys on the team, maybe even Digit. I haven't asked. I've been waiting a long time to walk out there in a match that means everything, my whole career. Al's, too. I earned it, and I want it. There are people out there watching who don't know who they'll be pulling for. They won't know until we're out there, when the first move gets made, and they'll wince or revel without even knowing it, and then they'll find out who they're for. If I was watching, that's how I'd be, but I won't be watching, so I'm pulling for me. Tommy Austin beat Anthony Terranova pretty good in the first match, and Larry Drummond pinned his guy at 119. There are no challenges at 125 or 130, so me and Al are up. Al is staring at me from across the mat, and Coach is waving us out there. Al's mad. He's 22-0, and nothing should be standing between him and the States, but somebody is. And I'm mad, too. I got down 2-0 almost before I had time to react. Al shot in and got me up in the air, flipping me onto my back, so I was in immediate trouble. I twisted and tried to get out of bounds because he already had the leverage he needed. But he yanked me back toward the center of the mat and started forcing me down. He wanted to get this over with, and he was being more aggressive than he'd ever been. He got near-fall points, but I managed to squirm out of it and get back to my knees. 5-0. He was still riding me. It took most of the period for me to work my way free, but I finally got to my feet and escaped just in time. 5-1. I was behind. Al didn't even leave the mat between periods. He just squatted with his hands on his knees and stared at the big blue S on the center circle, breathing hard. I walked off and grabbed a squirt bottle from Digit. Coach didn't look at me. I started the second period down, but escaped pretty quickly. Al does that. He'll give up an escape point to get two in return with a takedown. Usually, when he lets a guy go, he gives an evil smirk, kind of half-circles the guy, then goes in for the kill. But he came right back at me and threw me to the mat without any nonsense, and suddenly I was down 7-2, with his nails digging into my skin. For the next minute and a half, he rode me, trying to get me cradled to bring my shoulders to the mat. But he couldn't do it this time. Coach even started to warn us for stalling, since we were barely moving. But my efforts were maximum, and Al's were too. We just seemed to be on neutral ground, all of a sudden deadlocked. The second period ended, and I was down by only 5 points. Al was still mad, but it wasn't just at me anymore. He was mad at himself, I know, because this was going far too long, and there didn't seem to be much he could do about it. It had been a long time since he got tested like this, and now my confidence was escalating too. I was seething in a good way, a way I knew what to do with. I scanned the bleachers, looking for Kim and half expecting one of those movie-type breakthroughs where I'd catch her eyes and feel a lightning bolt of energy and desire that would carry me to victory. Instead, I saw my father, and the impact was different but the same. He was standing about three-quarters of the way up, arms folded, looking kind of dazed. I didn't try to catch his eye. I tried to share his dignity. I started the third period up, and Al was tensed below me, ready to explode to his feet the instant Coach blew the whistle. Maybe it's a cliche, but my life had come down to a 2-minute summary, the third period of this match. There was life on the other side, Kim, an escape from this town, my pride, but there was too much value in what had gone before to let it fade away without a defining moment. That moment had arrived. Al is pale, like sweaty marble coiled beneath me. The whistle blows, and instead of forcing up, he drops to the mat on his belly. My grip slips away. He rolls, and I grab the back of his thigh, jabbing my other arm over his shoulder. He gets to a knee. Coach gives him an escape point, but I swing up behind him and regain control. I've got him in a half Nelson, and I'm pushing with everything I have. Now he's down. I'm behind 8-4, but there's a chance here. Al's on the mat, face down, and every muscle in his back is flexed and extended. His right shoulder is coming up. It has no choice, because at this crucial moment, I'm stronger than he is. I have to lift him and turn him, and I give back an inch for every 2 that I gain. But I'm gaining, and he's groaning, and suddenly, he's perpendicular. His left shoulder is digging into the mat. His right is at a 90-degree angle toward the ceiling. That angle is growing shorter as I force him toward the mat. One hand is gripping my chest, but he has no leverage at all, no power. Time is getting short. Coach is kneeling beside us, palm flat, watching for that moment when both of Al's shoulders are planted firmly against the mat. The crowd sounds frantic, but maybe they're enjoying this. I'm up on my toes, pushing hard, using my knees and my gut and my thighs and my shoulders. I taste his sweat. He's pulling at my jersey and his headgear's slipping to one side. I don't know what's holding him up. It's my desperation versus his. 30 seconds, somebody yells. Digit it was. Is he telling Al to hold on or urging me to find something more, to finish this thing? I give one mighty surge, everything I've got left. He moves closer to the mat, but not close enough. I surge again and get nowhere, but I'm 3 inches from ending this thing, from pinning Al and walking away and moving on to where he'll never go. By sheer gravity, I should win this now, and all other things being equal. But he's defying gravity. He's defying me, too. 10 seconds, I hear. But 10 minutes wouldn't be enough. I give one final surge. Coach blows his whistle. 3, he says. It's over. Al lets go, lies flat on his back. I shut my eyes and get to my knees. 8-7. Digit pulls me up. The bleachers are nearly full and everyone is standing. Al shakes my hand. I clasp his arm and we walk off the mat. And Coach calls the next wrestlers onto the floor. It's over. My father is shaking my hand, too choked up to say anything, then handing me a $20 bill and telling me to take Kim out for dinner. I can take his car and he'll walk home. No, really, he says. Go, get a shower. Take this pretty girl out on me. You were great. She's got tears in her eyes and the next match hasn't started yet. Everybody's standing, cheering for Al and some for me, too. Coach is shaking his head and he's got a big grin, talking to the guy from the newspaper. Al and his father are hugging each other over by the water fountain, Digit standing next to me, patting my back. The pep band starts in with You Can Call Me Al, brassy and off-key just a little. Al raises his fist in the air. There's a crowd around him now. My father muscles my hair and mumbles, See you at home, then turns to leave. Digit says, Gotta see Al, and he goes, so I hug Kim and I kiss her on the forehead. Coach blows his whistle and the 145-pounders attack each other, and the band shuts up. Kim waits in the stands, and I go to the locker room. Nobody's in there. I shower a long time, letting the heat soak into my chest and through my head and down my feet. My season's over, but I've got shampoo left. I'll have to go out for track. I'm thinking Chinese food would be good, fried rice and snow peas, maybe some shrimp. My father doesn't have any decent tapes in his car. I'll borrow one from somebody. I like Kim. Digit has some good tapes in his locket, in his locker. Al will win the state, no question. The 189-pounders are wrestling by the time I get up there, and there's almost nobody left in the stands. I sit next to Digit, who's sitting next to Kim, and she and I hold hands behind his back until the last wrestle-off is over. We give him a ride home and then head to the Chinese kitchen in Weston. Digit's tape sounds good, even with the cheap speakers in this vehicle. Kim has her hair in a ponytail, and she's looking happy. This is a day I'll never forget. I get home late. My father is asleep on the couch, and the TV is on, but it's turned so soft you can barely hear it. Mom's still at work. I climb the stairs quietly. I'll let her be the one to wake him, and shut my door before turning on the light. It's just cold enough outside, so I take off my jacket and put on two sweatshirts, as much for comfort as for warmth. I can taste Kim's mouth and her skin. I smell her soft hair and feel her sweet, moist breath on my neck. And I feel Al's muscles, hard as steel and flexible as good, strong rope. And I feel his breath on my skin, too, cursing, straining, finally wanting it as much as I did. I sit on my bed to change from my running shoes to hiking boots, and then I see it there on the wall, the Elvis and Jesus thing from that house by the lake with "You Give Me Strength" scrawled on the cardboard matting. I stand and take a step toward it and stop, not sure whether to laugh or to shudder or feel honored. I shut the light and stand in the hallway in silence with my hands in the big pouch pocket of the sweatshirt. Then I walk down the stairs to my father. I touch him lightly on the shoulder and he rolls, opening his eyes and looking surprised. "Thanks, Dad," I say. "Oh, yeah," he says, sitting up and rubbing one eye with his hand. "Just, you know, I don't know." "Yeah," I say, "I know." We stare at the TV for a few seconds, then I turn to the door. "I'm just going for a walk," I finally say. I haven't been alone yet to absorb this day, to make it permanent. The woods are quiet, but my vision is good. The moon is out and shining. This was a day. This can be the day Al begins reliving his father's life or the day he breaks free. I think of Hatcher, too dumb to be a doctor like his dad, but just dumb enough to relive everything else about him. Only Digit is sure to break the pattern. Me? I don't know. I can see the lights of the town far below me, and a dog is barking in the distance. My father's asleep again by now, snoring on the couch with the TV on softly. He'll be punching in at the plant in 8 hours. I look at the moon, and it's right where it should be, 250,000 miles away. I stop walking and shut my eyes in the cool, clear breeze, lifting my arms above my head and inhaling. The air smells piney with just a hint of cows and of midnight. Life is good. I have Kim. I'm tired. I'm warm. And I'm alive. And that's it. That's the end. Wrestling Sturbridge. Took a little bit longer than I thought, but we got through it. And that is Rich Wallace's Wrestling Sturbridge, our second story of the night. And we'll come back again tomorrow night with another story for you. Not sure which. Maybe we'll go back to the Magic Treehouse tomorrow night. Who knows? We won't know until tomorrow night when Reading with Rick returns. Sorry I kept you up this late, but good night, everybody.